anybody remember that episode in I Love Lucy where the conveyor belt, she's at the conveyor belt, the chocolates, and it's just pure comedy because they start going faster than she can go, and then she starts stuffing them in her blouse, and she starts stuffing the chocolates in her mouth, and she's trying to keep up with it as fast as it comes, and that's how I feel this morning. I just feel totally overwhelmed by what the Lord is up to and what I could ever possibly communicate. I felt like today, as we're still on the mountain, Matthew 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, I felt like we could maybe imagine ourselves in this little building up on some kind of precipice, some kind of raised place where we're in intimate space with God and we're able to hear directly from Jesus this morning as he really is doing exactly what he told Deb. This morning there's always a trace of these three things when God speaks: correction, direction, affection. And without those three, he really wouldn't be a father. He would just be a wise man or a policeman or a coach or a good friend. But he's a father. And today I feel that mix of all three. I feel corrected, I feel directed, and I feel loved. So I've got a slew of thoughts, and we'll see what the Lord wants to do with it. Matthew 5, 13 through 20 is our text. I think I'll just start there. That's usually the best thing to do. But before I start in this text, which we do familiarly speak of as the Sermon on the Mount, and we are following up in the text what is also called the Beatitudes, the attitudes that we should be. Some have coined that phrase, a way of understanding it. I do want to just point out that as we take Matthew at face value and what he's been telling us about Jesus, that he is the Son of God, and he has come to bring his Father's kingdom. And it is not a kingdom that we've seen before, not in fullness. We've seen pieces of it. And this sermon that he's giving, it's not just to disciples, it's not just to crowds, it's to everyone who would dare come up on that mountain and listen. And he's giving it, at least as Matthew tells us, right after coming out of the wilderness, which he went into right after being baptized. And this, especially the wilderness, I think of the wilderness as a place I don't ever want to be in. And it's interesting that when Jesus comes and he is freshly spoken of by Matthew as the Son of God, he immediately goes into the wilderness. And in the wilderness, he's tempted, just like we are, to make shortcuts of the work that's ahead. And he's tempted to take power. He's tempted even to serve the devil in the name of getting what he actually wants. If that's not what we face constantly, I don't know what is. So out of this very place where Jesus identifies with us and being tempted, he goes up on the mountain. And on the mountain, these disciples that he's called to follow him dare to listen. And I felt that affection as I was replaying chapter 5 in my head today, as Debbie was speaking. You know, when Jesus comes to the mountain, and he says in chapter 5 that when he began to speak, and he taught them, saying, and he immediately goes into this dialogue of affection for you wherever you're at, for those who have been hurt, really put in a bad place. When he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I talked last week about saying, it's almost like he's saying, well, you could say happy, but it's really good news for anybody today that's poor in spirit. You know, it's what did I say? Welcome. I can't remember the exact phrase I used last week. That's where my head's at right now. But he's just, wherever you're at, if you find yourself poor in spirit, it's okay. Like it's going to be okay. I've got wonderful news. That was the phrase. I've got wonderful news for you. If you find yourself today poor in spirit, if you find yourself today mourning, I've got wonderful news for you. You're going to be comforted. If you find yourself today being of the meek, not the mighty, I've got wonderful news for you today, Mike Rice. You'll inherit the earth. And if you find yourself really hungry and thirsty today, which remember the disciples just forsake everything to follow him. He said, I've got wonderful news for you. You'll be filled. And if you're needing mercy, I've got wonderful news. I've got mercy. You're gonna receive mercy. And then if all you can see is one thing, which that's how I'm paraphrasing, pure in heart, I've got wonderful news. You're gonna see God. And if you're trying to make peace, and I don't know about you, but if you've ever tried to make peace in a schoolyard fight or in the middle of a corporate takeover, yeah, or in the middle of the NBA Finals, Game 7, it doesn't work very well for you, does it? You get trampled on when you try to make peace sometimes. But Jesus says, I've got wonderful news for you, peacemakers. You're the children of God. Just staggered by his love for us. As he calls us to be instructed, he is bringing that affection. That's just such a great word from the Lord. And when we feel his affection and we receive his correction, I got to tell you, you will find your direction. You will find the way to go. And it's the way of Jesus. So reading on from verse 13, I think we can hear those three phrases today. I think as we hear this, we're going to hear a little bit of correction, a little bit of direction, and lots of affection. Verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. But if salt's lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything, but it's thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand. And it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've come not to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. I do want to submit to you that this is a statement of affection, as much as correction and direction. I'd probably be obsessed with that all day today, Debbie. Thank you for delivering that word. That was so right on. One of the great church fathers John Chrysostom, some say that he was one of the greatest church father preacher. He said this about the scripture we just read, and I thought we should listen to it. As someone in the second century was chewing on the words of Jesus, and he certainly heard those three things that you said today, Debbie. John Chrysostom says, "You are the light of the world." And I just want to say again, you. You're the light of the world, those who are following Jesus. Not of a single nation, nor of 20 cities, but of the entire inhabited earth. You're like a light for the mind, far better than any particular sunbeam. Similarly, you are spiritual salt. First, you're salt. Then you are light. The metaphors of salt and light drive home the great benefit of these stinging words and the profit of this rigorous discipline. How it binds and does not permit us to become dissolute in our behavior. The person characterized by humility, gentleness, mercy, and righteousness does not build a fence around good deeds. Rather, that one ensures that these good fountains overflow for the benefit of others. One who is pure in heart and a peacemaker, even when persecuted for the sake of truth, orders his way of life for the common good. For the common good. This idea that he brings up about what Jesus just described to the people of God, to those who are following him, those who want to hear what Jesus has to say from the mountain. He's describing, and I love this, fountains. Fountains that are good and they're existing to overflow for the benefit of others. This is exactly what I meant when I was talking about this morning about God is more interested in establishing us in our calling than he is establishing us in a status. Do you know what I mean by that? I mean, one of the great statuses that we could ever hope to achieve or be called, I don't know that we can achieve it, is son. I'm a son. Well, Jesus really describes that as a status when he talks about the prodigal son and the older brother, how they live out this understanding of their status in two ways that really fall short of what it means to be a son. One of them is you've given and you're going to give some more because I need and I want and I'm going to do. That's the prodigal son. Prodigal son wants to take what's been given, which is the father's name, the father's inheritance, and he wants to run and do with it as he pleases. The second son is so caught up in the status of sonship that he doesn't even know how to dream as a son. He doesn't even know how to see beyond just the tightrope of obedience. And he's really upset when the father gives forgiveness to the first son. This is how it comes into my mind. For being a schmuck. For being just a kid that wastes what dad had given. Yet, in being such a miser over father's goods, he never lives out what it means to be a son. He's like a really good hired hand. Jesus hasn't called us into the status of sonship. He's called us. He's called us sons. He's called us into the activity, into the lifestyle, into the anticipation of what next, Father, and what are we doing together? He's called us not into just receiving, but into participating. I think it's perfectly expressed when we're talking about fountains, being called good fountains to overflow for the benefit of others. And as I read Isaiah, or Cheryl read Isaiah 58 this morning, I want to go back there because these scriptures really do speak to each other in a profound way. Isaiah 58, I'm just going to flip to my quick text here. Isaiah 58, as we heard it this morning before we started singing, and that was such a great job, Mike and Tori and Beth. Thank you so much. I always get worried when our scriptures are heavy. What are we going to do when the music comes? But it was just a perfect response. It was a perfect response, just declaring what God has done and what he's doing in and through us. It's amazing. Isaiah 58, I think, is more of what I've just been describing, that they were really frustrated because they had the status of being the people of God and they weren't seeing their prayers come through. Hello, anybody else feel like that sometimes? Goodness gracious, we've received the new covenant. We're not just in measured amounts of favor, we're in the measureless amounts of favor. Yeah, I can't even pray a cold away when I want to, right? I can't even help more than a couple neighbors at the most. I'm limited. Oh. And you hear this frustration in Isaiah 58. At least that's what we think we hear when they're calling out to God in verse 3. Well, I'll just back up into verse 1. Let's hear it again. The prophet Isaiah has come and he's giving them the word of the Lord. And he says to them this, shout out. Don't hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Be as loud as you can about what you have in your heart. Announce to my people, God says, their rebellion, to the house of Jacob, their sins. This is what they did. Day after day, they're seeking me. Huh? They're seeking me. And they're delighting to know my ways, as if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and didn't forsake the ordinances. They're coming after me and they're wanting to delight in who I am and they're wanting to love on me and seek me as if they were actually loving like I do. And does that hurt anybody else when you hear it? I'm like, why would you say that, God? Because it's correction. They don't understand that they are living with status and not in calling. They don't understand that they are reservoirs unto themselves at this point. And they're wanting more. And God's saying, I actually want you to practice who I am. I want you to live out who I am. And in that way, you're going to really start to truly delight in who I am. He goes on to say, let's just hear from the words of Isaiah. Why do we fast? He's quoting them. But you don't see. This is what Israel would say to God. Why humble ourselves, but you don't notice? And then God says back to them, look at yourself for a second. You serve your own interest on your fast day, and you oppress all your workers. You fast only to quarrel and to fight. And you fast to strike with a wicked fist. You basically are fasting to justify that you can do whatever you please. So such fasting is what is as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. And is that the fast I chose? A day to humble oneself? Is it to bow down and basically put on a show of humility? Is that what's acceptable to the Lord? And then we really get down to what God wants. And I think we always want to hear this. What does God want? What do you really want from me? Especially in a personal way. God, what do you want from me? Isn't it for me to put on a show of humility? Isn't it for me to want what you want? Isn't it for me to as Jeremiah said, isn't it to day after day seek you? Isn't it to delight to know your ways? And that's what they just cried out. What's wrong with that? That sounds exactly what we should organize church for, right? What he really wants is them to loose the bonds of injustice. Verse 6, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke. It's put in a question form because it's the Lord is questioning them. And he says, is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? And when you see the naked, to cover them? And not to hide yourself from your own kin? I'm in the New Revised Standard Version. Then your light shall break forth like the dawn. Let's not jump too quickly into that. The Lord's saying, when you do these things, then what you're asking for is going to happen. And I don't want us to look at this like a formula. This is what participation with heaven looks like. What does it look like to be a city on a hill? That's what God is really having this conversation with Isaiah and Isaiah with Israel about. What does it look like to delight in the Lord's ways? What does that really look like? Does it look like that you have the status, the vanity plate, city on a hill? Or does it mean that you actually are a city on a hill shining, like being the light of the Lord? That your light should break forth like the dawn and your healing shall spring up quickly. All that follows this question of setting the oppressed free, breaking the yoke, sharing bread, bringing homeless poor into our houses, seeing the naked, covering them. That is the light breaking loose. That's the light breaking into the dawn. Does anybody else have charismatic confusion like I do? I read this and I feel like I'm almost reading a riddle. Because I have called out to the Lord for miracles and manifestations, knowing his perfect love. At least I think I do. I mean, that's what I've said yes to. And I'm saying, Lord, give me the desires that you want. I'll change my heart to be like your heart. Lord, I delight to know your ways. I seek after you day after day. And the word of the Lord is, as if you practiced righteousness, right? Well, don't I? Well, do you? This is the words of Jesus. That he's inviting us to be a city on a hill. He says we are. Do you think that's status or do you think that's calling? What's the difference? Is there a difference? Shouldn't be. But I think we settle for a difference. I think it's because we're afraid. We're afraid of not having enough. Security or money or time or whatever I'm weaned on. I'm afraid I'm not going to have enough. And I'm tempted to settle for a religious action in my life that looks like Hallmark cards to Jesus. And it plays out as really me being unemployed in the kingdom. So there's some correction in this. But there's direction here, isn't there? Can you hear it? It's participate with me. I'm the one who breaks the chains of oppression. I'm the one who shares bread with the homeless, right? With the hungry. I'm the one who pours out. I'm the one who keeps dishing out. Participate with me. You want sonship? I'm it. I'm not giving it to you as status. It's a calling. We really don't want it as a status. Status is when you get given something because you fit that category. It's being token. Does anybody want to be the token son in the kingdom of God? I'm so glad that's not what he offers us. And doesn't the wave of condemnation come at the door. It just like comes up to the door. I could feel like a wave coming at me of you haven't done enough. Did anybody feel that? When you start thinking about participating with God, I mean, suddenly I see Joshua and I prayed a couple weeks ago on Wednesday night, the prayer that, Father, forgive us for what we've done and forgive us for what we failed to do. I hear that prayer loud and clear in my head when I think about the calling of Jesus. I really feel like, oh Lord, all those things I've failed to do. And I have to tell you, he never speaks a corrective word without affection. He's never spoken a word to us that was separate from who he is. I mentioned all that about Matthew and his setup to the Sermon on the Mount because Jesus, yes, he was declared the Son of God. That's how his ministry begins. He's the Son. This declaration of who he is. But if he's more than a status symbol. He has a calling of sonship. And with that calling, he immediately does this thing that no one in their right mind would do. He heads towards the wilderness. He heads to take on every temptation and to show the devil, the enemy, the accuser, what it means to be a son. Which is not about, do I have enough by myself? Can I win this victory by myself? Should I tempt God by my assumptions? No, it's this trust that he goes into the wilderness with, isn't it? He goes in this with this deep trust. Everything he does is this setup for Father, which Matthew takes us all the way through. All the way through his gospel, we see Jesus living out the reality that he's not just status, he's living in the calling of being a son, which is Father's backing me up. As I step out into giving my own life, he's going to back me up. He's going to back me up in what appears to be a meaningless sacrifice. Just a random Jew on a random day. You know, it's not recorded in Rome's records that they killed Jesus. It wasn't like, oh, in that day we killed the really important one. They don't keep records of such things. It was supposed to be forgotten. And Jesus, as he gives his life, as he pours out everything, there is no altar call that day, is there? There is no parade, even on the third day after he rose. He entirely trusts the outcome to Father. And you and I today are the fruit of his labor. In fact, if we did the count live on Facebook today, we would find, you can't even count how many people have been affected by Jesus. Because Father and him were in it together. He was living out his calling. Isaiah 58 is in a sense a setup for Jesus, isn't it? It's the ministry of Jesus that Isaiah 58 is longing. It's pointing towards and it's longing for. And it's also the ministry that we find our identity in because this is what it looks like to live in the call of who God is in the earth. Verse 10, if you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness and your gloom be like the noonday. The Lord will guide you continually. There's direction. And satisfy your needs in parched places. I think that's affection. And make your bones strong. And you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water, whose waters never fail. Your ancient ruins, that means all those old places where you failed and the generations before you have failed, and not one thing that was ever done before you amounted to be anything worth eternity. Ugh, sounds like an existential crisis. Yes, it is. Well, guess what? I'll rebuild that too. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. That's all of you in this room. And you shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to live in. Now, I don't know about you, but this is what the Lord is saying that he's going to call us. This is what he's saying he's going to do in and through us if we remove the yoke from among us, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil. Basically, if we live in the calling. If we live in the calling. This is not a behavior measurement, a litmus test to see if we deserve it. Don't ever hear it like that. But it is an indicator of what our source is. As Chrysostom said, I just think this is so right on. The person characterized by humility, gentleness, mercy, righteousness, does not build a fence around good deeds. Rather, ensures that these good foundations overflow for the benefit of others. I think this is why the church exists. We exist to ensure that the good foundations in us from Father overflow to the benefit of others. Does that sound right to you? Why? That's why the church exists. I mean, it also exists, as Jesus says in Matthew 5, I think this is very right on, for the poor in spirit, for those who mourn, for the meek, for the hungry and thirsty, for the merciful, for the pure in heart, the peacemakers, the persecuted, that we would come sometimes so beaten and downtrodden, and the Lord's, he's there greeting us. He's there even ahead of us. He set us up, tricked us into coming back to him sometimes. He's there anticipating us. But he's also there as we receive him saying, we're not building a fence around this. You're a river. You're created to be a river in me, to overflow. Can you feel that? Isn't that the truth of it? That we're not called to be reservoirs, just that one day, you know, don't even touch that thing. It's stagnant waters. Let it be. Isn't that church a great place that is loved by God and doesn't do anything for anybody else? Isn't that wonderful? That sounds so false, doesn't it? I mean, we know that's false as soon as we say it. I really hear the Lord just today calling us into this participation again. I'm struck by how the very thing we want, which is to delight in him and to see chains break. And man, I want to be that city on the hill, don't you? I mean, he calls me to be it. I certainly don't want to be the cave in the valley. You're the dark cave in the valley. Which would you rather be? The city on a hill or the dark cave on the valley? I mean, I think Facebook exists because we all want to be a city on a hill. Like, we all want the world to know what we're doing that's so good. Or even if it's bad, we still want to be seen. We want to be seen. We want to be known. We're all hungering to be known and seen and to have something worthy for another person. And he calls us, he says that's what I've called you to be. But it's not status. It's calling. It's to participate with him. I feel like I can easily be tricked at times especially when I look back and I think how I've been so frustrated with God, because really what was going on is I had built a fence around what he'd given me. And I was wanting him to make a theme park out of it. And he's like, your architectural plans and mine are really different. Theme parks overflow. I want to overflow with you, Scott. Would you trust me with your plans of your fence? Of course I trust you, God. Would you really? Did you not hear me, God? I said, of course. Well, I'm going to tear down your little fence then. No, that's not kind. I have a theology that says God loves me. You wouldn't do that. You don't understand, son. You've built a 6x6 garden plot that's more suited for your casket than your celebration. Oh, Lord. Why'd you have to put it like that? I want to read a little story. I don't think it'll take too long, but I just thought this story just really said it right. It's by Tolstoy, Leo Tolstoy. Maybe some of you know it. It's called Where Love Is, There Is God Also. Does anyone know it? Good. So I am going in storyteller mode, but I think this is a fitting end to what the Lord is doing with us. Isn't it interesting, I'll just say this, that we've really judged the Pharisees in our world, the scribes and Pharisees, we've really thrown them out as being almost horrible even, when the truth is, what they had done was construct a system to actually help the world around them. That's what they were trying to do. The problem is, when you construct a system, it still becomes status, and then you have to guard status. But when you trust King Jesus, he draws you into the wilderness sometimes. He draws you away from what you find is manageable, because he wants to do something greater. And he tells the disciples as much when he says to them, I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. What a wild statement to tell them. It's basically an acknowledgement that they do have a form of righteousness, that they are doing some good in the world. But I want more from you than just being a do-gooder. And I think this is where we try to live. You know, I try to live in the place where I don't want to be just a do-gooder. But then I think sometimes we get separated. This is my observation from above the world, looking down on our movement in Christianity. It's like we're so afraid of being stagnant waters and doing things out of obedience and service, that we stop doing things. we stop being the ones that take chains off of people. We stop putting ourselves in harm's way because we say, well, he loves me. He'd never want me to stand on that bridge in Memphis and get harmed. No. The disciples, if I just remind us, they were not called to a comforted life, were they? But yet they were sent the comforter. Isn't that just the answer we need to hear today? And I hear out loud from a distance over this whole message, fear not, okay? Fear not. I just feel like the Lord is, and this is my last big statement, I feel like the Lord is, this church has such destiny over it because A, we're part of his church. Isaiah 58 has been the call of this particular church as it's been the call of the church for thousands of years now. Why is that? Because he's doing something and he's invited us into it. And yes, we need some correction, but also the direction we're actually crying out for is right there. It's right there as we receive his affection today. And that he's not putting out some limbo stick. You know, how low can you go? He's actually showing us today that he is the lowest. He's gone the lowest. He's gone the farthest. He's touched the scaliest person, right? Like, he's gone and loved the most unlovable people. I'm proof of that, right? Like, we're all proof of that today. And what does he come out with of it with? This great testimony of how faithful Father is. That Jesus isn't some isolated son. That he's one of many brothers and sisters now. That we're all in this family of God. Are you guys okay? Sometimes I feel like I talk you into thinking too much, and maybe that's where we're at. I don't know. All right, here we go. There's a couple Russian things in here, and I'll translate if I need to, because I did the research. This is an easy story, though. This is not complicated. This is not John Chrysostom. This is simple. In the city lived the shoemaker. I'm just going to call him Martin. Martin Avidovich. And he lived in a basement in a little room with one window. The window looked out on the street. And through the window, he used to watch the people passing by, although only their feet could be seen. Yet, by the boots, Martin recognized the people. Martin had lived a long time in one place, and he had many acquaintances. Few pairs of boots in this district had not been in his hands once and again. Some he would half-sole, some he would patch, some he would stitch around, and occasionally he would also put on new uppers. And through the window, he often recognized his work. Man, wouldn't shoe buying be so much simpler? Avidovich had plenty to do because he was a faithful workman. He used good material, he did not make exorbitant charges, and he kept his word. If it was possible for him to finish an order by a certain time, he'd accept it. Otherwise, he would not deceive you. He would tell you so beforehand, and all he knew, and all who knew Avidovich knew that he was never out of work. He had always been a good man, but as he grew old, he began to think more about his soul and how to get nearer to God. Martin's wife had died when he was still living with his master. His wife left him a boy 3 years old. None of their children had lived. All the eldest had died in childhood. And Martin at first intended to send his little son to a sister in the village, but afterward he felt sorry for him. And he thought to himself, it will be hard for my Kapitoshka to live in a strange family. I shall keep him with me. And Avidovich left his master and went into lodgings with his little son. But God gave Avidovich no luck with his children. As Kapitoshka grew older, he began to help his father and would have been a delight to him. But a sickness fell on him. He went to bed, suffered a week, and died. Martin buried his son and fell into despair. So deep was this despair that he began to complain of God. Martin fell into such a melancholy state that more than once he prayed to God for death and reproached God because he had not taken him, who was an old man, instead of his beloved only son. Avidovich also ceased to go to church. And once a little old man from the same district came from Choitza, which is the word for Trinity. It's a famous monastery. And he came to see Avidovich. For 7 years, he had been wandering about. And Avidovich talked with him and began to complain about his sorrows. I have no desire to live any longer, he said. I only wish I was dead. That's all I pray God for. I am a man without anything to hope for now. And the little old man said to him, you don't talk right, Martin. We must not judge God's doings. The world moves not by our skill, but by God's will. God decreed for your son to die, for you to live. So it's best for the best. And you are in despair because you wish to live for your own happiness. But what shall one live for? Asked Martin. And the little old man said, we must live for God, Martin. He gives you life, and for his sake, you must live. When you begin to live for him, you will not grieve over anything, and all will seem easy to you. Martin kept silent and then said, but how can one live for God? And the little old man said, Christ has taught us how to live for God. You know how to read? Buy a testament and read it. There you will learn how to live for God. Everything is explained there. And these words kindled a fire in Avidovich's heart. And he went that very same day, bought a New Testament in large print, and began to read. And at first, Avidovich intended to read only on holidays. But as he began to read, it so cheered his soul that he used to read every day. And at times he would become so absorbed in the reading that all the kerosene in the lamp would burn out. And still he could not tear himself away. And so Avidovich used to read every evening. And the more he read, the clearer he understood what God wanted of him and how one should live for God. And his heart kept growing easier and easier. Formerly, when he lay down to sleep, he used to sigh and groan and always thought of his Kapitoshka. And now his only exclamation was, glory to thee, Lord, thy will be done. And from that time, Avidovich's whole life was changed. In other days, he too used to drop into a public house as a holiday amusement to drink a cup of tea, and he was not averse to a little brandy either. He would take a drink with some acquaintance and leave the saloon, not intoxicated exactly, yet in a happy frame of mind, and inclined to talk nonsense and shout and use abusive language at a person. Now he left off that sort of thing. His life became quiet and joyful. And in the morning he would sit down to work. He'd finish his allotted task, then take the little lamp from the hook, put it on the table, get his book from the shelf, open it, and sit down to read. And the more he read, the more he understood, and the brighter and happier it grew in his heart. Once it happened that Martin read till late into the night. He was reading the Gospel of Luke. He was reading over the 6th chapter, and he was reading the verses. And unto him that smiteth thee on one cheek, offer also the other. And him that taketh away the cloak, forbid not to take thy coat also. Give to every man that asketh of thee, and of him that taketh away thy goods, asketh him not again. And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. He read farther, also those verses where God speaks. And why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not do the things which I say? Whosoever cometh to me, and heareth my sayings, and doeth them, I will show to you whom he's like. He's like a man which built a house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock. But he that heareth and doeth not is like a man that without a foundation built an house upon the earth, against which the stream did beat vehemently, and immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great. Avidovich read these words, and joy filled his soul. He took off his spectacles, put down the book, leaned his elbows on the table, and became lost in thought. And he began to measure his life by these words. And he thought to himself, is my house built on the rock or on the sand? 'Tis well as if on the rock. It's so easy when you're alone by yourself. It seems as if you had done everything as God commands. But when you forget yourself, oh, you sin again. Yet I shall still struggle on. It's very good. Help me, Lord. Thus ran his thoughts. He wanted to go to bed, but he felt loath to tear himself away from the book. And he began to read farther in the 7th chapter. He read about the centurion. He read about the widow's son. He read about the answer given to John's disciples. And finally, he came to that place where the rich Pharisee desired the Lord to sit at meat with him. And he read how the woman that was a sinner anointed his feet and washed them with her tears, and how he forgave her. He reached the 44th verse, and he began to read. And he turned to the woman and said unto Simon, seest thou this woman? I entered into thine house. Thou gavest me no water for my feet, but she hath washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman, since the time I came in, hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil thou didst not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with ointment. He finished reading these verses and thought to himself, thou gavest me no water for my feet. Thou gavest me no kiss. My head with oil thou did not anoint. And again, Avidovich took off his spectacles, put them down on the book, and again he became lost in thought. It seems that Pharisee must have been such a man as I. I too apparently have thought only of myself, how I might have my tea, be warm and comfortable, but never to think about my guest. He thought about himself, but there was not the least care taken of the guest. And who was his guest? The Lord himself. If he had come to me, should I have done the same way? Avidovich rested his head upon both his arms and did not notice that he fell asleep. Martin suddenly seemed to sound in his ears. Martin started from his sleep. Who is here? He turned around and glanced toward the door. No one. Again, he fell into a doze. Suddenly, he plainly heard, Martin. Ah, Martin. Look tomorrow on the street. I am coming. Martin awoke, rose from the chair, began to rub his eyes. He himself could not tell whether he heard those words or in a dream or in reality. He turned down his lamp and went to bed. At daybreak next morning, Avidovich rose, made his prayer to God, lighted the stove, put on the cabbage soup and gruel, put water in the samovar, which is an urn used to boil water, put on his apron, and sat down by the window to work. And while he was working, he kept thinking about all that had happened the day before. It seemed to him at one moment that it was a dream. And now he had really heard a voice. Well, he said to himself, such things have been. Martin was sitting by the window and looking out more than he was working. When anyone passed by in boots, which he did not know, he would bend down, look out the window in order to see not only the feet, but also the face. The house porter passed by in new felt boots. The water carrier passed by. Then there came up by the window an old soldier of Nicholas's time and an old pair of laced felt boots with a shovel in his hands. Avidovich recognized him by his felt boots. The old man's name was, we're going to say, Stephen. And a neighboring merchant, out of charity, gave him a home with him. He was required to assist the concierge. Stephen began to shovel away from the snow from in front of Avidovich's window, and Avidovich glanced at him and took up his work again. Pshaw! I must be getting crazy in my old age, he said, laughing at himself. Stephen is clearing away the snow, and I imagine that Christ is coming to see me. I was entirely out of my mind, old dotard that I am. And Avidovich sewed about a dozen stitches and then felt impelled to look through the window again. He looked out again through the window and saw that Stephen had leaned his shovel against the wall and was warming himself, resting. He was an old, broken-down man. Evidently, he had not strength enough even to shovel the snow. Avidovich said to himself, I will get him some tea. By the way, the kettle has only just gone out. And Avidovich laid down his awl, rose from his seat, put the samovar on the table, poured out the tea, and tapped with his finger on the glass. Stephen turned around and came to the window. Avidovich beckoned to him and went to open the door. Come in, warm yourself a little, he said. You must be cold. May Christ reward you for this. My bones ache, said Stephen. Stephen came in and shook off the snow, tried to wipe his feet so as not to soil the floor, but he staggered. Don't trouble to wipe your feet. I will clean it up myself. We're used to such things. Come in and sit down, said Avidovich. Here, drink a cup of tea. And Avidovich filled two glasses and handed one to his guest, while he himself poured his tea into a saucer and began to blow it. Stephen finished drinking his glass of tea and turned the glass upside down to signify he was satisfied, a custom among the Russians. And he put the half-eaten lump of sugar on it, and he began to express his thanks. But it was evident he wanted some more. have some more, said Avidovich, filling both his own glass and his guest's. Avidovich drank his tea, but from time to time he glanced out into the street. Are you expecting anyone? Asked this guest. Am I expecting anyone? Oh, I'm ashamed even to tell whom I expect. I am, and I am not. Expecting someone, but one word has kindled a fire in my heart. Whether it was a dream or something else, I don't know. Don't you see, brother? I was reading yesterday the gospel about Christ. They say the Batyushka, which I looked that up, and Christ the Batyushka is a Russian way of talking about Christ the priest in the Orthodox culture, but think of it like this, Christ the pastor. Christ, the common shepherd. So he said, I was reading in the scriptures about Christ, the Batyushka, how he suffered and how he walked on the earth. And I suppose you've heard about it. Indeed, I have, replied Stephen, but we are people in darkness. We can't read. Well, now I was reading about that very thing, how he walked on the earth. I read, you know, how he came to the Pharisee. And the Pharisee did not treat him hospitably. Well, and so, my brother, I was reading yesterday about this very thing, and I was thinking to myself how he did not receive Christ the Batyushka with honor. Suppose, for example, he should come to me, or anyone, I said to myself, I should not even know how to receive him. And he gave him no reception at all. Well, I was just thinking. I fell asleep, brother, and I heard someone call me by name. I got up. The voice, just as if someone whispered, be on the watch, I shall come tomorrow. And this happened twice. Well, would you believe it? It got into my head. I scolded myself, and yet I'm expecting him, the Batyushka. Stephen shook his head and said nothing. He finished drinking his glass of tea and put it on the side. But Avidovich picked up the glass again and filled it once more. Drink some more for your good health. You see, I have an idea that when the Batyushka went about his earth, he disdained no one and had more to do with simple people. He always went to see the simple people. He picked out his disciples from among folk like such sinners as we are, from the working class. Said he, whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and he who is humbled shall become exalted. Said he, you call me Lord, and said he, I wash your feet. Whoever wishes, said he, to be the first, the same, shall be a servant to all. Because, said he, blessed are the poor, the humble, the kind, the generous. And Stephen forgot about his tea. He was an old man and easily moved to tears. He was listening and the tears rolled down his face. Come now and have some more tea, said Avidovich. But Stephen made the sign of the cross, thanked him, turned down his glass and arose. Thanks to you, Martin Avidovich, for treating me kindly and satisfying me soul and body. You are welcome. Come in again. Always glad to see a friend. Stephen departed, and Martin poured out the rest of the tea, drank it up, put away the dishes, and sat down again by the window to work, to stitch on a patch. He kept stitching away, and at the same time, looking through the window. He was expecting Christ and was all the while thinking of him and his deeds. And his head was filled with the different speeches of Christ. Two soldiers passed by. One wore boots furnished by the crown and the other one boots that he had made. Then the master of the next house passed by in shining galoshes. Then a baker with a basket passed by. All passed by. And now there came also by the window a woman and woolen stockings, and rustic clogs on her feet. She passed by the window and stood still near the window case. Avidovich looked up at her from the window and saw it was a stranger, a woman poorly clad and with a child. She was standing by the wall with her back to the wind, trying to wrap up the child, and she had nothing to wrap it up in. The woman was dressed in shabby summer clothes from behind the frame. Avidovich could hear the child crying and the woman trying to pacify it, but she was not able to pacify it. Avidovich got up, went to the door, ascended the steps and cried, "My good woman, hey, my good woman." The woman heard him and turned around. "Why are you standing in the cold with the child? Come into my room where it's warm. You can manage it better. Here, this way." And the woman was astonished. She saw an old man in an apron with spectacles on his nose, calling her to him. She followed him, and they descended the steps and entered the room. The old man led the woman to his bed. Now, you remember, this old, different time. "There," says he, "sit down, my good woman, near to the stove. You can get warm and nurse the little one." "I have no milk for him. I myself have not eaten anything since morning," said the woman. But nevertheless, she took the baby to her breast. And Avidovich shook his head, went to the table, brought out the bread and a dish, opened the oven door, poured into the dish some cabbage soup, took out the pot with the gruel, but it was not cooked as yet. So he filled the dish with the shi only, which is like the broth, and put it on the table. He got the bread, took the towel down from the hook, and spread it upon the table. "Sit down," he says, "and eat, my good woman, and I will mind the little one. You see, I once had children of my own. I know how to handle them." And the woman crossed herself, sat down at the table, and began to eat, while Avidovich took a seat on the bed near the infant. Avidovich kept smacking and smacking to it with his lips, but it was a poor kind of smacking, for he had no teeth. The little one kept on crying, and it occurred to Avidovich to threaten the little one with his finger. He waved his finger right before the child's mouth, and hastily withdrew it. He did not put it to its mouth because his finger was black and soiled with wax. And the little one looked at his finger and became quiet. Then it began to smile, and Avidovich also was glad. While the woman was eating, she told who she was and whither she was going. "I am a soldier's wife. It's now 7 months since they sent my husband away, and no tidings. I lived out as a cook. The baby was born. No one cared to keep me with a child. This is the third month that I've been struggling along without a place. I ate all I had. I wanted to engage as a wet nurse. No one would take me. I'm too thin, they say. I've just been to the merchant's wife, where lives a young woman I know, and they promised to take us in. I thought that was the end of it. But she told me to come in next week, and she lives a long way off. I got tired out, and it tired him too, my heart's darling. Fortunately, our landlady takes pity on us for the sake of Christ and gives us a room, else I don't know how I should manage to get along." Avidovich sighed. "Haven't you any warm clothes?" "Now is the time, friend, to wear warm clothes, but yesterday I pawned my last shawl for a 20 kopeck piece." The woman came to the bed and took the child, and Avidovich rose, went to the partition, rummaged around, and succeeded in finding an old coat. "Nah," says he, "it's a poor thing, yet you may turn it to some use." The woman looked at the coat and looked at the old man. She took the coat and burst into tears. Avidovich turned away his head. Crawling under the bed, he pushed out a little trunk, rummaged in it, and sat down again opposite the woman. And the woman said, "May Christ bless you, little grandfather. He must have sent me to your window. My little baby would have frozen to death. When I started out, it was warm, but now it has grown cold. And he, the Batyushka, led you to look through the window and take pity on me, an unfortunate." Avidovich smiled and said, "Indeed, he did that. I've been looking through the window, my good woman, for some wise reason." And Martin told the soldier's wife his dream and how he heard the voice, how the Lord promised to come and see him that day. "All things are possible," said the woman. She rose, put on the coat, wrapped up her little child in it. And as she started to take leave, she thanked Avidovich again. "Take this, for Christ's sake," said Avidovich, giving her a 20 kopeck piece. "Redeem your shawl." She made the sign of the cross, and Avidovich made the sign of the cross, and went away with her to the door. And the woman went away. Avidovich ate some shi, washed the dishes, and sat down again to work. While he was working, he still remembered the window. And when the window grew darker, he immediately looked out to see who was passing by. Acquaintances passed by, and strangers passed by, and there was nothing out of the ordinary. But here, Avidovich saw that an old apple woman had stopped in front of his window. She carried a basket with apples. Only a few were left, as she had evidently sold them nearly all out. All over her shoulder, she had a bag full of wood chips. She must have gathered them up in some new building and was on her way home. One could see that the bag was heavy on her shoulder. She tried to shift it to the other shoulder. So she lowered the bag on the sidewalk, stood the basket with the apples on a little post, and began to shake down the splinters in the bag. And while she was shaking her bag, a little boy in a torn cap came along, picked up an apple from the basket, and was about to make his escape. But the old woman noticed it, turned around, and caught the youngster by his sleeve. The little boy began to struggle, tried to tear himself away, but the old woman grasped him with both hands, knocked off his cap, and caught him by the hair. The little boy was screaming. The old woman was scolding. Avidovich lost no time in putting away his awl. He threw it upon the floor, sprang to the door. He even stumbled on the stairs and dropped his spectacles and rushed out into the street. The old woman was pulling the youngster by his hair and was scolding, threatening to take him to the policeman. The youngster was defending himself, denying the charge. "I did not take it," he said. "Why are you kicking me for? Let me go." Avidovich tried to separate them. He took the boy by his arm and said, "Let him go, Babushka. Forgive him, for Christ's sake." Babushka's grandmother in Russian, if anyone doesn't know. He says, "I will forgive him so that he won't forget. Till the new broom grows, I am going to take the little villain to the police." Avidovich began to entreat the old woman. "Let him go, Babushka. He will never do it again. Let him go, for Christ's sake." The old woman let him loose, and the boy started to run. But Avidovich kept him back. He said, "Ask the Babushka's forgiveness, and don't you ever do it again. I saw you take the apple." The boy burst into tears and began to ask forgiveness. "There now, that's right. And here's an apple for you." And Avidovich took an apple from the basket and gave it to the boy. "I will pay you for it, Babushka," he said to the old woman. "You ruin them that way, that good for nothing," said the old woman. "He ought to be treated so that he would remember it for a whole week." "Eh, Babushka, Babushka," said Avidovich. "That is right according to our judgment, but not according to God's. If he is to be whipped for an apple, then what ought to be done to us for our sins?" And the old woman was silent. And Avidovich told her the parable of the master who forgave a debtor all that he owed him, and how the debtor went and began to choke one who owed him. And the old woman listened, and the boy stood listening. "God has commanded us to forgive," said Avidovich. "Else we too may not be forgiven. All should be forgiven, and the thoughtless especially." The old woman shook her head and sighed. "That's so. But the trouble is, they are very much spoiled." "Then we who are older must teach them," said Avidovich. "That's just what I say," remarked the old woman. "I myself had 7 of them. Only one daughter is left." And the old woman began to relate where and how she lived with her daughter and how many grandchildren she had. "Here," she says, "my strength is only so-so, and yet I have to work. I pity the youngsters, my grandchildren, but what nice children they are. No one gives me such a welcome as they do. A skintho won't go to anyone but me. Babushka, Babushka, the loveliest." And the old woman grew quite sentimental. "Of course, it's a childish trick. God be with him," said she, pointing to the boy. The woman was just about to lift the bag on her shoulder when the boy ran up and said, "Let me carry it, Babushka. It's on my way." And the old woman nodded her head and put the bag on the boy's back. And side by side, they passed along the street. And the old woman even forgot to ask Avidovich to pay for the apple. And Avidovich stood motionless and kept gazing after them. And he heard them talking all the time as they walked away. And after he saw them disappear, he returned to his room. He found his eyeglasses on the stairs. They were not broken. He picked up his awl and sat down to work again. And after working a little while, it grew darker so that he could not see to sew. He saw the lamplighter passing by to light the street lamps. "It must be time to make a light," he said to himself. So he got his little lamp ready, hung it up, and betook himself again to his work. He had one boot already finished. He turned it around and looked at it. Well done. He put away his tools, swept off the cuttings, cleared off the bristles and ends, took the lamp and set it on the table, and took down the Gospels from the shelf. He intended to open the book at the very place where he had yesterday put a piece of leather as a mark, but it happened to open at another place. And the moment Avidovich opened the Testament, he recollected his last night's dream. And as soon as he remembered it, it seemed as if he heard someone stepping out behind him. Avidovich looked around and saw there, in the dark corner, it seemed as if people were standing. He was at a loss to know who they were, and a voice whispered in his ear, "Martin, Martin, did you not recognize me?" "Who?" exclaimed Avidovich. "Me," repeated the voice. "It was I," says Stephen, stepping forth from the dark corner. He smiled, and like a little cloud, faded away and soon vanished. "And it was I," said the voice. From the dark corner stepped forth the woman with her child. The woman smiled, the child laughed, and they also vanished. "And it was I," continued the voice. Both the old woman and the boy with the apple stepped forward. Both smiled and vanished. And Avidovich's soul rejoiced. He crossed himself, put on his spectacles, and began to read the evangelists where it happened to open. On the upper part of the page, he read, "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in." And on the lower part of the page, he read this, "Inasmuch as you've done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me." And Avidovich understood that his dream had not deceived him, that Savior really called him on that day, and that he really received him.